Welcome in to a Monday morning edition of the Locked On Knicks podcast. I'm your host, Gavin Shaw, going solo to break down a thrilling weekend of Knicks basketball. We're going to talk about Kyrie Irving flirting with the New York Knicks. Excellent articles by Kevin O'Connor and Howard Beck on the Kristaps Porzingis trade. And then we'll get into the last two games, a spirited effort from a ragtag group of backups against the Boston Celtics. And then some thoughts on the newcomers' debuts against the Memphis Grizzlies. All that and more next on Locked On Knicks.
You are Locked On Knicks, your daily New York Knicks podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
Knox foul from behind, count it at one. As Fisdale pumps his fist.
What he does is contagious.
Robinson with a catch and slam. Across the lane to Trier. Trier drives down.
Becomes infectious.
You are Locked On Knicks, your daily New York Knicks podcast. Again, I'm your host, Gavin Shaw. Alex is at work. He has something called a day job and another thing called responsibilities, whatever those are. I'm sitting on my couch right now, and the initial plan was for me to record this yesterday afternoon before the Super Bowl, but you know how it is. You're kind of scrambling to get to a party. I also did a hit on Locked On NBA talking about the Kristaps Porzingis trade that all of you should check out, though it'll probably piss off about 60% of you, judging from most of the Twitter interactions we've been having with the podcast, unless there's a silent majority that is with me on the slightly pro Kristaps trade, waiting to hear some more comments that we'll actually get from him later today when he has his opening press conference with the Dallas Mavericks. So that should certainly be interesting to parse out. Maybe we'll do something with Alex later tonight talking about those. So I kind of wanted to record tomorrow, or rather yesterday afternoon. That didn't happen. And then I was like, okay, I'll just do it after the Super Bowl. But oh, that game just, it really sucked. I hated that the Patriots won. I hated that, at least in my mind, the only reason they won was because Drew Brees and the New Orleans Saints got cheated out of a spot there. I think Drew Brees, maybe the Patriots would have scored more as well, but I think Drew Brees gets a little bit more than 3 points against that defense. No shots. Sean McVay, Jared Goff, you broke my heart a little bit. Okay, enough of that, because we have a loaded Knicks-centric podcast for you, and we are starting off on something we can all agree on is a positive thing. Kyrie Irving maybe sending a little late-night you-up message to Scott Perry and Steve Mills. So this little flirtation happened Friday night before the Knicks-Celtics game, an eventual 113-99 win for Boston. And Kyrie had a variety of comments, both in the pregame and in the morning shoot-around. One of the most interesting ones was him kind of clarifying that he is going to do what's best for himself, which isn't controversial in and of itself, but obviously everyone remembers the preseason comments from Kyrie Irving at a Celtics, I believe it was a season ticket holders event, where he said, if you guys will have me, I want to be back next season, essentially committing to Boston. And I can't remember if we weren't doing the podcast at that point. I'm not sure. I'm sure James probably talked about it back then, but I know even from a Nets perspective, we were talking about that, and it was like, oh, well, that kind of closes the door. So now Kyrie is changing his tune a little bit, asked specifically whether his mindset has changed since those original comments. He said, quote, ask me July 1st, implying that, yes, they could have shifted. And then someone kind of pushed forward and said, so does that kind of change your commitment to re-signing with the Celtics? And he responded, I don't owe anybody shit. So that's good. Kind of addressing the Knicks directly, he said, I respect the Knicks organization. Obviously, they are making moves to position themselves for this upcoming summer, so I wish them the best. Obviously, a little vague, and there are a number of ways to interpret this, because Kyrie did also go on to clarify that Boston's still at the head of the race. And on Howard Beck's podcast, I believe it was is Chris Mannix clarifying that, at least as far as what Kyrie has told the Celtics front office, he's still generally in the same state of mind that he was this preseason, and they believe that he's coming back. And Mannix suggested these comments could be construed as a means of Kyrie putting pressure on the Celtics to go trade for Anthony Davis and ensure that their initial offer to him is a max contract without any qualifiers, specifically given his injury history with his knee. So I guess a lot to parse out there, but the general takeaway is that I don't know how much I buy that. Like, I get like that, like, I wouldn't put it past Kyrie to play games like that and to just kind of troll the New York media a little bit while also sort of putting the Celtics on notice, being like, hey, I want to come back, but if you screw up, I'm willing to look at my options and I have options. Like, that is probably, like, again, like, being totally objective, like, the most likely interpretation of this. But I also, I wouldn't rule it out because, again, he is best friends, or not best friends, but really good friends with Kevin Durant. He's also really good friends with Anthony Davis, though we also saw the comments from Anthony Davis's dad that he would never want his son to be on the Celtics long term. Now, if the Celtics trade for him, Kyrie stays there, they go on to win a title, that probably all shifts. So who knows how solid that is. But I guess my big picture point on this is, if you're from the greater New York area, and obviously Kyrie grew up in New Jersey, but according to Mannix, playing at MSG has always held a certain fascination for Kyrie, and the idea of doing that with Kevin Durant and the opportunity to take a Knicks franchise that is going through one of the worst stretches any big market team has ever gone through in NBA history. I mean, you could even wipe that off the table. It's one of the worst 20-year stretches that any team has gone through in NBA history. And to come in and immediately be, I mean, this might be sacrilegious for the 70s Knicks fans out there, but the best duo in Knicks history, because, I mean, Durant, right off the bat, most talented player the Knicks will have ever employed, that is pretty exciting. And that's kind of unique. And for a guy from this area who obviously grew up with some measure of Knicks fandom, or at least some appreciation for the stage that they play on night in and night out, that kind of intrigues me a little bit. Okay, let's take a break. When we come back, we will get into dueling opinions on the Kristaps Porzingis trade via articles from Howard Beck and Kevin O'Connor. That next on Locked On Knicks. Thanks for joining us back on a Monday morning edition of the Locked On Knicks podcast. Remember, you can follow us on Twitter at Locked On Knicks, and you can shoot us an email if you want at LockedOnKnicks@gmail.com, because we are going to do a trade mailbag later this week. Very excited to get into that, so you can shoot us some questions over there, or you can leave us an email on our voicemail. The number I did not have prepared, and I do not remember off the top of my head, but we will get to you next podcast. It is also, I believe, if not pinned on our Twitter feed, I'll get another tweet up, including that early this week. So an opportunity for you guys to get involved. We're actually going to have, I think, more ways for you guys to get involved with the podcast. That's a little tease, because we have to go over that with Alex. Don't necessarily have details on it yet, but something we are figuring it out, and maybe a way to get some fans on the podcast. Anyways, with that in mind, let's keep this going. Two articles with dueling perspectives on the Kristaps Porzingis trade. Howard Beck of Bleacher Report, more in line with what I've been saying. Some of you would call it Porzingis propaganda. Kevin O'Connor, more in line with what a lot of you have been telling me you are into on Twitter. The upside of this trade. And I'm not an unreasonable man. I want to present both perspectives. I see a little bit of the other argument for sure. And I'm intrigued by the possibilities this trade presents. So let's start off with West Coast Zach Lowe. Kevin O'Connor of The Ringer, writing the Kristaps Porzingis, not a takedown piece, but a defense of the trade. First, he gets into KP's injury history, which is something we touched on the last podcast, but maybe for some of you we didn't do enough justice to. Porzingis has missed 110 of a possible 296 games in his career. Now, you take this season out, that number looks a little bit, or rather, I guess, it's like a full season total since he tore his ACL now, so that's like 80 games out. Before that, it wasn't all that bad. It was something like he missed 30 out of about 210, which isn't great, but he was playing. The issue was he was rarely at 100%. He would start every season. He'd be super, super good. If you remember, just last season, after about 10 games, like people were talking about him as kind of a dark horse MVP candidate if the Knicks could have snuck into the playoff race. He was legitimately playing that well, one of the most effective scorers in all of basketball, and then he tailed off, and that was very similar to his first two seasons where he hit kind of a proverbial wall and just didn't really seem to have the juice that he showed off in early season games. And to that point, that was often a product of a variety of lower body injuries. I counted it out because KOC was nice enough to list all of them in the article. He dealt with 11 different lower body injuries in his first three seasons as a Knick. And that is obviously something that could certainly continue going forward. I know just listening to a couple different podcasts, doing research, even remembering at the time, that was something Phil Jackson was very concerned with. And apparently part of the reason that he was thinking about dealing Porzingis even as far back as the summer of 2017. KOC continues by not necessarily attacking Porzingis, but talking about the upside of this deal in terms of free agency moves. And now the consensus of this article and the Beck article, this is kind of the one place where they link up in their ideas, is that the Knicks really must have a strong feeling that Kevin Durant is coming. And that's something we mentioned on both podcasts we recorded on Friday. But just to give a little bit more background on why KD might potentially be interested, his agent, Rich Kleiman, a lifelong Super Knicks fan, has been very open on Bill Simmons' podcast about his desire to one day either be the GM, president, or to be involved in the Knicks organization at a higher level. And a guy that would certainly have a lot of influence over KD and would be inclined to push him towards New York. KD also has a relationship with Scott Perry, who worked for the Seattle Supersonics in Durant's 1 year there. Perhaps even more importantly, he has called Knicks assistant coach Royal Ivy his best friend in the NBA and his favorite teammate ever. Ivy was on some of those early Kevin Durant Thunder teams. And then him and Kyrie Irving are very close. And the Knicks, at least as of now, I think this will change by the end of the season and other teams will find a way to create room. But as of now, they are the only team with room for both of those guys. So if they want to play together and they both have different connections to the Knicks organization, you can kind of do the math. The final argument from KOC is if you want to look at this trade as, instead of how can Dennis Smith Jr. help the Knicks, as a pure asset grab for the New York Knicks. They all of a sudden have a theoretical package to acquire Anthony Davis. And if you saw that SportsCenter segment by the great Bobby Marks circulating on social media, the Knicks, at least for the first year, would have camp room for all three of those guys, Anthony Davis, Kevin Durant, Kyrie Irving, which is something of a wet dream for all Knicks fans. Now, I'm not sure how that would work going forward and once Anthony Davis signed a bigger contract, but obviously simultaneously with that, the cap is going to go up again. And if you want to give James Dolan credit for one thing, he's generally not cheap. With that cap rise, it would obviously mitigate the luxury tax hit against the Knicks and maybe make that somewhat of a palatable scenario. So something to dream about for Knicks fans. All right, for the opposite, not totally the opposite perspective, both these pieces had a lot of nuance, but somewhat the opposite perspective, I would say more so in line with my thinking as an eternal pessimist in regard to the New York Knicks, Howard Beck's article. Basically, the consensus around the league, at least the initial reaction, I think, but this was kind of the initial reaction to everyone. I imagine if you ask these same executives their opinion on the trade a few days later, it might be a little bit more balanced, but the initial reaction around the league was this trade was kind of insane. There was one quote from a veteran executive saying, quote, "It's never happened. Teams have given up unprotected picks, but no one's ever traded an established star, an established commodity just to clear money." And I know what a lot of your responses to that would be, that Kristaps Porzingis was not an established star. And to that, I would say he was the closest thing the Knicks had and was certainly on that trajectory. Next quote from an executive, the same guy. "The only reason you can justify doing it is you have some level of certainty in your own mind that you're going to get KD and Kyrie or KD and whatever." So that's kind of in line with what we got from the KOC article. And then Beck kind of presents the counterpoint to that. What if the Knicks whiff on Kevin Durant? And this is kind of what we talked about last podcast. The Knicks, I mean, for all the glam of the garden, for all the attraction of New York, and those are real factors, they have a very poor history with signing free agents. The two best guys they've ever gotten were Amari Stoudemire with TNT wrapped around his knees, and Allen Houston, who sort of worked out, but not really. He didn't really get the best contract necessarily. Anyways, they have never signed anything close to a Kevin Durant free agent. And you can say that for most teams, but again, it's true that the Knicks have never pulled this off. And they thought they were going to pull this off in 2010. There were even, I remember Bill Simmons just said on his podcast, there was an idea, and like he believed to a point that LeBron and Wade wanted to go to New York in 2010, and New York screwed it up. And then again, you can make the case New York is more competent now. You could also make the case that they are not. They're also a team that, and I understand that they're conscientiously tanking to a point, but they are a team that has lost 21 of 22 games. So they're not exactly the best situation in basketball, even if their approach right now is one that I agree with and one that I think will help them long term. So, but there is a world where Durant wins a title and says, you know what, I have a dynasty. Why would I leave this? There's a world where Kyrie Irving keeps his preseason promise to stay in Boston. There's a world where Kemba Walker backs up his claims all season and stays in Charlotte. There's a world where things turn around in Philly and Jimmy Butler wants to stay there. There's a very real world where Kawhi Leonard says, you know what, I love this situation in Toronto. Or, you know, if I'm going to leave, why wouldn't I go back to LA? Where, I don't know if he grew up in LA, but I think he grew up in SoCal. Where I grew up. Those are all possibilities. And here's the thing that some people underestimate. And some people, at least on Twitter, were all right with this. I personally would hate this. If you get just one of these guys, and Durant is maybe the exception to this rule, but I think if Durant comes, it's going to be because there's a second star here. But if you get just one of these guys, you get just Kemba Walker, you get just Jimmy Butler, even if in some weird world you get only Kawhi Leonard, you're right back on the treadmill of mediocrity. And the Knicks have been on that treadmill for 20 seasons, where you're not good enough to land consistent top five picks and really build out a young roster, or you're in a situation where you're just constantly competing for the 6th, 7th, and 8th seed. And I don't know about you guys, for me, it's been too long since, I've never experienced a Knicks team that had a feasible shot at a title. The closest we got was the first 23 games or so of 2012-13, where it looked like the Knicks were going to be one of the best teams in the NBA, but even that wasn't sustainable because they were really relying on like a 40-year-old Jason Kidd, who apparently was not on whatever Tom Brady was on because he has fallen off since then. The next point from Beck, this is the one that I was making kind of all day, like my immediate reaction to the idea that they were going to trade Porzingis because he was allegedly unhappy. The Knicks didn't have to grant a trade request. If you want to go so far as to say it was a trade request, then only the Knicks have flat out said it was a request. That we've heard preference to be traded. He threw it out there. It's just been the Knicks so far that have said Porzingis, quote unquote, demanded a trade. They could have, I mean, just directly quoting Beck here, they had the right to match any deal Porzingis signed this summer. They could have waited at the store, found other avenues to clear cap room, locked up Porzingis for 5 years, and used him to draw star free agents. And I understand everyone's counterpoint on that. Well, he said now that he's just going to sign the QO with Dallas, so why wouldn't he just do that in New York in a place where he clearly wasn't happy? And that's maybe a fair argument, but I would say, let me see you do it, KP. Let me see you actually sign that qualifying offer. Because I don't think he's going to do it. I think at the end of this year, Mark Cuban is going to drop down the 5-year, $158 million offer, and Kristaps Porzingis is going to sign that sucker, because if he comes back and he can't move, guess what? You're not making $158 million. And I think he knows that. I think he's immature, maybe in some ways, but I don't think he's dumb. So I think he's going to take the $158 million. And maybe he doesn't. Maybe I'm proven wrong on that, and I'll eat crow. If he does sign a qualifying offer this summer, then obviously the Knicks were not in the position of leverage that I think they're in. And you could make a compelling case that they were well within their rights to trade him. All right, a few more quotes, and we will wrap up this segment. Another veteran GM described this trade as perplexing and short-sighted. Another source saying they absolutely did not do their due diligence. And that one is consensus around the NBA, that the Knicks could have been more thorough in parsing out what deals were available to them. Now, did they just think that Dallas was the perfect trade and they weren't going to get better? Maybe, but I would argue that functional NBA teams, and even some of the non-functional ones, you find out everything that is out there. You find out if you can possibly bring back a blue chipper and clear space, and I would not call Dennis Smith a blue chipper. And the Knicks absolutely did not do that. And that in and of itself makes me think that this trade was rushed and wasn't as thoroughly vetted as it could have been. And I think it takes away some of the Knicks' credibility in taking kind of the high ground on this deal. Speaking of credibility, that's kind of the heart of Howard Beck's next point. He writes, the Knicks also lost some credibility. It was just a few months ago that team president Steve Mills publicly asserted that the Knicks, after years of foolish short-term fixes, impulse buys, and leaps for every shiny object, would take a methodical path forward, build through the draft, develop their youth. And even knowing his injury situation, even knowing that he possibly wanted out, this is not doing that. This is chasing the shiny object. This is saying, we're going to get some free agents. We're going to be good right away. We can rush this rebuild. The Knicks have been trying to microwave their timeline for 20 seasons now, and it's never worked in any sustainable way. And it rarely works for any team. The Miami Heat were kind of unique in the sense that they got three stars at the same time. And obviously, you can reference the Warriors getting Kevin Durant, but that team was built on the draft. It was getting Steph Curry with the 7th or 8th pick in the draft. It was getting Draymond Green in the second round. It was getting Klay Thompson outside of the top 10. And you can argue the Knicks maybe have a little bit of that base with guys like Mitchell Robinson, Alonzo Trier, Kevin Knox, Frank Ntilikina, who look like they have a lot of potential. But again, these guys haven't put it together yet. And that makes sense given three of them are still teenagers. But even taking that into account, or maybe specifically because of it, you can't build a team that's going to win a title next season, or at least NBA history says that's very, very unlikely. All right, final quote. And this is one that they could have taken straight from the Locked On Knicks Twitter, because we essentially said the same thing. If they strike out, they will all be fired, a rival scout said. Crazy risk, but I kind of like it. So those are the stakes for Steve Mills and Scott Perry. You execute this summer, you make good on what was in a vacuum an insane deal, then you've been 100% validated, and this plan wasn't crazy because clearly you had some intel saying that you were going to get two stars this summer. You don't do that? You screw this up that severely? They should both be gone. And it's just that simple in my mind. All right, with that, we'll wrap up our second segment. We'll come back. Maybe I'm not doing enough justice to the Celtics and Grizzlies games by just giving them one segment, so we could do something with Alex tonight. I'll talk to him about that. But we'll come back, final segment, some quick thoughts on the Celtics and Grizzlies games next on Locked On Knicks. Welcome back, third and final time on Locked On Knicks. I am Gavin Shull, going solo on this Monday. It started off as a Monday morning edition. It's probably going to turn into a Monday early afternoon, late afternoon edition by the time you're hearing it. The Knicks lose back-to-back games against the Boston Celtics and the Memphis Grizzlies at home. I think they've now lost 14 straight in MSG, 21 of their last 22 in total. And because of that, I don't really want to do a traditional recap of these two games. I kind of want to just go over what players, what moments, what ideas stood out to me between these two games. So I will give a quick shout-out. I thought they had really good fight against the Boston Celtics. They were down by 21, kind of got their way back into that one, particularly considering the circumstances, extremely shorthanded with losing Courtney Lee, Tim Hardaway, and Trey Burke in that Dallas deal and not having the new Mavericks come in yet. So credit to the Knicks, credit to David Fizdale. Clearly, at least at this point, that's his greatest strength. As a coach, the ability to get guys motivated, regardless of the night, regardless of the situation, it is the ultimate testament to how the guys in the locker room feel about him. So shout out to Coach Fizz. All right, with that, let's get into it. Interesting little two-game run for Kevin Knox. He was really, really good against the Boston Celtics. I thought it was one of his better performances on the season. Plays 40 minutes, 9 for 21 from the field. Finishes with 21 points, 5 rebounds, 2 assists. I just loved what we saw from him just from a shot profile perspective. For the majority of the game, he was getting mostly threes and layups. And if you've been listening to this podcast, that's been something that I've been begging for him to hunt down a little bit more. And I think just inherently it will turn him into a more efficient player than relying on kind of a steady diet of mid-range twos, because that sort of seems to work for everyone. And that's why the entire NBA is going in that direction. But even more than that, I just love some of the stuff we saw from him off the dribble. He had this one play where Cantor set a pick and roll, or set a pick for him, and Jaylen Brown was trailing the play, who's a very, very good one-on-one defender, even though he's having a little bit of a disappointing season for Boston. But Knox just had the dexterity to crouch down, sort of contort his body around Cantor, which isn't really something I've seen him do before. And then he beats the ensuing double team from Aaron Baines and ends it with a high arcing floater. Like, that's just a very high level play, and it's one that you see top point guards in the league make relatively routinely. Guys like Paul Nash in his day, Mike Conley, another guy who can pull that off with some level of frequency. You don't see it from the Kevin Knoxes of the world all that often. There aren't too many 6'8", 6'9", 6'10", however tall he is at this point, guys who can do that. And then there's some other really nice moments off the dribble. He absolutely dusted Brown on a double crossover after recognizing that there was an opening on that side of the floor. And he sort of faked towards the strong side, crossed back to the weak side, and just had a wide open lane for an easy bucket. In the third, he started going back to kind of his bread and butter. A lot of jumpers off the dribble, which when he's already set up a defense by hitting threes and hitting layups and he's in a really good rhythm and he's feeling confident, I don't mind as much. I just hate when he comes out of the gate trying to take those shots. And just on the whole, he was super smart, super aggressive on both ends. Even this play in the first quarter where I'm trying to remember who it was that got burned. I think it was Cantor, double the ball. Baines rolled, would have had a wide open dunk. And Knox just sprints over from the corner and gets a foul on Baines. And it's like a really routine play, but it's one that smart defenders make all the time. And it's one that proactive defenders make all the time. And those are two words that you couldn't really use with any kind of consistency to describe Knox's play on the season, but he showed flashes of both of those qualities on that particular play, and it's something that sort of makes me bullish on his defensive upside going forward. He still has a lot of room to work one-on-one, but just the fact that he was aware is, I think, a really good sign for him. Against the Memphis Grizzlies, he was mostly bad. He had 17 points, with just 5 of 18 shooting from the field, and that's kind of another thing you're looking at Knox. Obviously, on this team, he kind of has the ultimate green light, especially when they're still incorporating the new guys. Like, he's sort of the focal point offensively, but you have to know when you have it. You have to know when you don't. And I go back and forth on this because it doesn't matter right now if the Knicks lose games. If anything, it's actually encouraged. And I'm generally a proponent of young guys stretching out their skill sets to the fullest extent. But I do think it's damaging to have inefficient night after inefficient night after inefficient night without any kind of repercussion. And it's on David Fizdale to maybe bench him for a stretch if he takes a series of bad shots, or at least to like inform him that those are bad shots. And I'm sure that's happening on some level when watching film. But Fizdale doesn't, again, he's not like an overly analytically inclined coach. So when Knox is bricking mid-range jumper after mid-range jumper, I can kind of see Fizdale just saying, all right, just keep shooting him. Which, again, I like the mentality, but it has to be the right kind of shot and it has to come within the flow of the offense. If not, as a coach, that's kind of your responsibility to get on the guy. So at least going forward, and I've said this a million times on the podcast, but I'll continue to say it, just hoping for a little bit more efficiency from Kevin Knox. Credit to him for only hitting 5 shots and still finding a way to get to 17, though, because earlier in the season, when he would have shooting nights like that, he would probably have only like 9 or 10 points. So you got to give credit where credit is due. All right, moving on to Alonzo Trier. He was really good against the Celtics. He was really mediocre against the Memphis Grizzlies. He continued to show a really good chemistry with rim-rolling bigs, had a nice alley to Mitchell Robinson against the Celtics off a drive, and then a couple of good interior looks for DeAndre Jordan, including one oop in the game against the Grizzlies. And it just, the explosiveness to get in the paint continues to be the biggest surprise with him, because again, going into the season, I thought that was kind of the reason that he didn't get drafted, was that even though he was a good scorer at the college level, most scouts didn't think his burst off the dribble would really translate to the NBA level. And when he's healthy, it has. And not just offensively, but defensively, he had a monster block on Terry Rozier. And there have been a couple times this season where you've seen him have those flashbulb moments defensively, and you're just kind of shocked because it just wasn't really his MO at all coming into the NBA. But the fact that Trier is showing that off on both ends is really, really exciting. Also, maybe this belongs in an overtime segment, but I thought it was hilarious when against the Celtics, I think it was the fourth quarter or maybe late in the third, there was it was either an inbounds or a pass off a rebound to Mario Hezonja. Trier literally goes sprinting up to him, puts a hand on his chest, and basically just takes the ball away from him. And you know Mario Hezonja, he was going to bring the ball up the court with zero hesitation. And I think nothing better sums up Trier as a player that he even the idea of someone bringing the ball up the court when he's supposed to be the nominal point guard was unpalatable to the point that he would literally physically stop Mario Hezonja from doing it. So that was kind of entertaining. Speaking of Mario Hezonja, he's been on a pretty decent run of late. And I don't see him by any means as a long-term component of these Knicks teams, but give him some credit. When the Knicks haven't really had anything else going of late, he hasn't always been efficient, but he's found a way to contribute almost night in and night out. And he's made some really good passes of late. Like, the guy is just strong, and he can throw some bullets. There was a really nice connection between him and Kadeem Allen on the last play of the first quarter against the Grizzlies, where Allen just throws this, like, 30-foot on a dime bullet pass up to Hezonja, who hits a buzzer-beating three to end the first. And those are two guys who aren't necessarily heralded because the Knicks haven't won at all recently, but both of them doing a nice job. Like, I feel like every time Kadeem Allen's in there, and I think I saw Zach DeLuzio tweet something similar to this, and I really strongly agreed with it. Every time he's in there, like, it feels like they're running a functional NBA offense to a degree for, like, the first time in forever. And, like, not necessarily, like, consistently, but he just plays with a level of pace to his game that's totally absent from Emmanuel Mudiay and Emmanuel Mudiay's game. And a lot of time, Frank Ntilikina's game. And Trey Burke, I guess, had it to a degree, but he had it where he was just constantly searching for his own shot. Kadeem Allen plays with pace to set up teammates, and that is a quality that's been missing from Knicks point guards for a while, so it's kind of nice. And I think because of it, the Knicks get a lot of good looks when he is in the basketball game. All right, I want to get into DSJ, DeAndre, and Wesley Matthews, but we are running super long on the solo edition. Like, I'm sure you guys are getting tired of my voice at this point. I will say quickly, I liked a lot of the flashes that I saw from Dennis Smith, even though the statistics weren't particularly good, just 8.6 rebounds, 3-for-9 shooting in 26 minutes, 0-for-3 from 3-point range. And, like, none of his threes were particularly close to going in, which is sort of the biggest thing to watch the rest of the season if he can hit that shot with any kind of consistency. But just his ability to run an offense, particularly that second quarter drive that Knicks Film School tweeted out, where he burst into the lane, help defender comes over in Marc Gasol in the midst of a Euro step. Another guy is coming over from the baseline, and out of the corner of his eye, Smith kind of recognizes that and just pings this high-speed pass into the corner to Knox for an open three. And it was just the type of high-level read that, again, I haven't watched a ton of Dennis Smith in the NBA, but when I have seen him, I haven't seen him make that read a whole lot. I certainly didn't see him make it a whole lot at North Carolina State. And it's kind of a next level thing that maybe he learned a little bit playing under Rick Carlisle, playing with heady point guards like Devin Harris and J.J. Barea. But it's a quality that for him to have any future as a starter in the NBA, he's going to have to show that off with a lot more consistency. But I thought a really good sign that he flashed in his first game. And especially in the first half, he made the right decision time in and time out. And even more than the shooting, because hopefully the shooting will come with time. That's kind of what I'm looking for out of him, because if you can combine that level of decision-making with his athletic ability and hopefully a functional shot down the road, I think he maybe does have a future with the Knicks, and if not, has a future as a really good backup or maybe even a starter if he really hits his ceiling on another team. And that's something, if the Knicks sign a Kyrie Irving-type player or a Kemba Walker-type player, they could use to potentially trade him to another team and pick up another asset. So I thought that was kind of exciting. All right, we haven't totally settled it yet, but might be back later in the day with Alex Wolf. If not, we will talk to you guys after Tuesday's Pistons game. And the good news is we got a lot of time. Wednesday and Thursday are both off, so we will be able to get you some extra podcasts kind of breaking down all this. I know you guys want to hear Alex's thoughts on maybe some of the KP aftermath, whatever he says in his press conference today. The news just broke that the Knicks have a number of teams that are interested in Wesley Matthews, so maybe a potential trade there, whether the Knicks just buy him out and someone signs him. All that is going to be extremely fascinating. I'll say this much. It's a crazy time to be a Knicks fan, and there is a lot to talk about, so I'm thankful for that. And I'm really thankful for you guys, because the podcast we did on Saturday was by no small margin far and away the most listened to of the me and Alex era of this podcast. I would imagine, even including James and Jared Dubin, it was one of the most listened to ever in Locked On Knicks history. So even though it's, at least from my perspective, a really tough time in Knicksdom, I'm glad you guys stuck with us. I'm glad you guys are interested, and we'll hopefully keep bringing you good content. Hope you have a great day, and we will be back either tomorrow morning or Wednesday morning after the Pistons game.